Come plan your dream wedding all in one day at the 17th Annual Newport Bridal Show on March 3rd. Meet with more than 80 top wedding professionals at two of Newport's most romantic venues, Rose Cliff and Ocean Cliff Mansions. Visit NewportBridalShow.net to buy your ticket today.
Once upon a time, as a Senate staffer, someone asked me why I thought Christianity spread in its earliest years. I danced by questions of divinity, and I flippantly replied, good staff work. Today's guest takes that same question more seriously and traces the power of stories told and untold in the growth of the early church. She's Karen L. King this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to understand the stories that shape politics, policies, and popular life in the United States. To do that, we sit down each week with journalists, scholars, filmmakers, and more to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. To help us this week, we're joined by Karen L. King, the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School. Karen, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So stories that matter. There's arguably no bigger set of stories that's been told than the stories we find in the Bible. But you got your route to the study of religion and divinity sort of through a circuitous route. How did you make this journey?
You mean from my...
From your childhood,
small,
yeah.
No, from, sure. Well, it's I think, fairly serendipitous. You know, one thing after another. I was raised in this small town of about 600 people in southwest Montana. I always tell people that the local park was Yellowstone. You know, I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful, beautiful country. I ended up at the University of Montana, which was a local, the local university, but at Montana at that time was this extremely lively program in religious studies. And so even though I had gone there to, do pre-med, I think like a lot of people, thinking you're going to do good in the world, I ended up being drawn to this department and this faculty. And
was it a particular professor that transformed your experience?
No, I think it was really the group, because I studied Native American with Joseph Epps Brown and with the Native American Studies faculty, and I did philosophy of religion and Kierkegaard with other people and biblical studies with other people. And when I applied to go to graduate school, I actually applied in several different programs, and I went to the place that quite frankly gave me the most money, which I think people with educational debts these days would understand, and ended up studying early Christianity.
And where was that you ended up studying early Christianity?
Well, apart from my undergraduate degree in Montana, I ended up at Brown University.
Okay, and then you
went here in Providence.
In Providence. Yeah. And then you went to Occidental College, is that correct?
So that was my first job.
Yeah, and what was that job?
That was in early Christianity, in the religion department.
Then you spent a year and a half in Berlin, and I'm not sure if I have the chronology here correct, but that was a very pivotal experience, too. What did you do there? That was in the early 1980s.
Yes, well, you were asking me earlier about somebody pivotal at the University of Montana. Well, that was where I was first exposed to these new writings that were found in Egypt in 1945. And they were not yet published. The English translations were just coming out. The texts were just being published. And I was fascinated by them. And so I went to graduate school to work on those. And at Brown, they said, my advisor said, you can do that here. And so I thought, I can do that there. And he eventually called me into his office and said, well, actually, I thought you'd change your mind. And so I put in for a fellowship with the Deutsche Akademische Austauschdienst and ended up in Berlin studying with Hans-Martin Schenke, who's one of the world experts on these materials.
And what are these texts?
So we have to go back to a jar, okay, in which were found 13 papyrus books. Some of them, in fact, some of the oldest books in terms of book forms in the world. And in them were a collection of early Christian literature. Now, the books themselves are probably 4th, 5th century, but the texts go back to the 2nd and 3rd century, and they are gospels, they are letters, they are apocalypses written by early Christians about which we basically didn't know anything. At most, we had maybe a title or something.
So we want to sort of get into this in some depth. Why didn't we know? Why were they lost? Why were they sitting in some clay jar buried in the sands for millennia?
Well, in some ways, those are two different questions, right? Because most early Christian literature is lost. I mean, I think Protestants think we have the New Testament, so we have the early Christian literature we need, right? And we have a lot of later literature, but most early Christian literature written in these centuries is lost to us. We know that from titles and so forth, because in antiquity, if you didn't copy something, it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, so the question is, why were these preserved? You know, who put them in a jar? Who thought they were worth saving? Why were they hidden? You know, and fortunately for us, of course, they were hidden in a very, very dry place, you know, where papyrus tends to survive. So that's been the real question for scholars. Why were these texts hidden? And somehow I think it's because they were very important to a set of Christians exactly in this period, in the 4th, 5th centuries. But at the same time, this is when Christianity began to take a more set kind of form. You know, it's when we can really start to, you know, look at the conversion of Constantine, you know, the Roman emperor, to Christianity. It's when we see the, you know, a kind of solidification of what we think of now as Christianity. You know, the creed, the canon, you know, church structures, buildings, all of that really, you know, had history before that for sure, but they came to be set. And it's at this time when it was possible now to start enforcing right doctrine and
orthodoxy.
Yeah, orthodoxy and heresy. And these texts were you know, generally on the side of heretical material. And so we think probably what somebody did was to cull them perhaps out of the local monastic library, you know, and hide them away at a time when such books were
being censored, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah.
So Mary Magdalene is a pivotal character in the Bible. And you have, through your study, come up with a different portrayal of Mary. Talk to us about that, because I think that's one of the critical pieces of your work. She's been portrayed sort of in traditional Christian thought as a wayward woman, and perhaps even a prostitute. And that's not what you have found. Talk about Mary.
Yeah, it isn't just me. You know, other especially feminist scholars have really brought this to the fore. It's widely recognized now. And the story about Mary as a prostitute or as a whore, you know, interestingly enough, only belongs to Western Christianity. You know, the Eastern churches never had that story. You know, but what we see happening is that in the New Testament Gospels, in the story of the life of Jesus and so forth, Mary Magdalene is probably the foremost woman. You know, she's there during Jesus' ministry. She's the one at the cross. She is, in the Gospel of John, the first to see and talk to the risen Jesus. So this is actually the New Testament portrait of her, the canonical portrait of her. But what happens in later centuries is that she becomes conflated. That's to say, she gets mixed up with some other women in the New Testament who aren't named. One of these is the sinner woman with the alabaster jar in Luke 7. Another one is the prostitute the woman caught in adultery in John 8. And so these women become Mary Magdalene's, okay? And so on one track of her story, she goes forward as the repentant sinner. And she becomes iconic in the West as the repentant sinner. And Pope Gregory the Great of Rome is the one who, again, kind of put, you know, we often point to as the one who put it all together. But he was using her as a figure, interestingly enough, to call others to repent, to use her as a model of the ideal, the ideal Christian, the woman who repented and who went on. On the other side, another Gregory, also writing in the 6th century, this time from Antioch. So he's the Eastern Christianity guy. He's talking about Mary Magdalene in John 20. That is to say, the story where she's the first one to encounter the risen Jesus and told to go and tell the other disciples that he's risen, right? So he's saying, look at this woman. Oh, he calls her teacher of teachers because she's sent to tell, you know, the other disciples. And he uses her as a rebuke to Peter, who denied him, because in all the Gospels we have this story about Peter denying Jesus three times, you know, denying that he knows him, that he's his disciple. And so she's the faithful one who sees the resurrection, and she's the one who denies Peter, right? And then he goes on and says, and let Peter know that I can appoint women to be apostles. So this is what's happening in the Eastern churches in the 6th century. So we have these two different portraits. But this portrait of Mary Magdalene, the prostitute, goes forward, you know, into the modern period. But anybody can pick up their New Testament, their Bible, and see that there's nothing there about Mary Magdalene, the prostitute. It's simply an invention of a later period.
So why do a lot of people who read the Bible accept that as the correct interpretation? I mean, that seems to be anti-feminist at the very least. I mean, painting her as a villain of some sort as opposed to the person you have described.
Well, this is the power of tradition. This is the power of storytelling. I mean, you guys do story in the public square, right? This is the power of stories. And so if you have a story, if you have an artistic tradition and a literary tradition of a person, you read it in. You know, you read Mary Magdalene and you know who she is, you read it into the story. It's like the way people read the story of Adam and Eve as a story of original sin. But of course, the word sin doesn't appear in that story. Or the story that they ate an apple. It doesn't say apple, it just says fruit. That's Milton,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, but you know it, and so you read it and you know, my students, I say, go look. And they go like, oh my goodness, there's no apple. You know, where'd the apple go? You know?
I think a lot of our audience is going to go look and say, wow, she's right, there is no apple.
So is it too much to say that the depiction of Mary Magdalene as a prostitute or as a fallen woman is political?
Ah, well, it's certainly historically inaccurate. And it certainly has had an enormous impact, you know, on the status of women and how women have been treated. Because you have, you know, Mary the Virgin Mother, and then you have Mary the Repentant Prostitute. And these become the primary models. Do we want to call that politics? Well, you know, power relations are involved, mm-hmm. you know. And it's definitely had an impact, you know, on how women are treated. And in the exclusion of women from the kind of leadership position that we see Mary Magdalene take already in the Gospel of John, you know, as the teacher to the other apostles, and as we see her in some of these texts discovered in Egypt, you know, primarily in one that I work on called the Gospel of Mary.
The Gospel of Philip.
Yes, there's another one.
There's another one, and in the Gospel of Philip, Mary is portrayed as having been married to Jesus. Do I have that correct?
Well, this is debated, but I've argued that. It calls her his partner, his consort. It uses this language that elsewhere in the text only means to imply a sexual relationship married, to talk about the relationship between Jesus and Mary. So here's one case where we have in the early church, probably dating to the 3rd century, that portrayed Jesus as married. Now, of course, the New Testament doesn't say anything about whether Jesus was married or not.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can hear this show 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square at the studios of Rhode Island PBS with a wonderfully talented crew. and we're grateful for the chance to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me in the co-host chair, as he does every week, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist who is also the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is a historian of the early Christian church. Karen L. King is the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School. So I teach a global history course at Salve Regina University, and we spent some time talking about the early Christian church. And one of the things that I always sort of have to navigate is sort of the my own personal views and my own personal religious beliefs,
sure,
and what we know as historians. How do you navigate that? How do you? This is the, you know, you're working with a set of texts that that the Catholic Church, anyways, has described as heretical. Right? Do you have to differentiate between your own personal set of beliefs and what you know as a scholar and as a historian? Is that something that you have to navigate?
For me, the study of religion and the study of religion, whether as a historian or you know as a literary critic, these other kinds of ways, are all about deepening one's understanding and deepening one's faith. You know, and the notion that somehow one needs to check one's brain at the door. You know, when you enter into religion is not just unfortunate, it's probably maybe even tragic. You know, and so for me, these studies deepen my faith. You know, they provide a kind of complexity and a kind of breadth and width to the story of Christianity and to the faith that early Christians had that provide really important places, I think, for modern believers to enter in and to become sort of critical and constructive at the same time about what their faith is. You know, I think we all know it's kind of a stereotype to think that, you know, Christian believers, people who believe the Bible, have done good and they have done ill. So it's incumbent on believers to think carefully and to sort through them, and not just to assume because texts are canonical, because they are a large part of the faith, that they can't be read in ways that can be harmful. And I think understanding the history of these traditions, where they came from, seeing the wider story, recovering things like a more historically accurate portrait of Mary Magdalene, is a good thing.
So your work has been met with some degree of controversy from people, I assume, who embrace the orthodoxy. Is that true? Or, I mean, have you had people object to portraying Mary as you described her here?
I think it's controversy and religion are words that often come together.
Yeah, you think, and looking around the world, the history of the world, yeah.
And if you add in, you know, issues about sexuality and gender and, you know, marital ethics and theology and the kinds of things that I work on, it puts you right in the middle of those. And certainly in our time, you know, the issue about women's roles, about women's issues about leadership, but also issues about sexuality, these are very, very important and controversial issues. And so my work puts me right in the middle of that. And yes, there's been pushback for sure.
And you know, you're now at the Harvard Divinity School. You're the Hollis Professor of Divinity, which is the oldest endowed chair in the United States?
It's the oldest endowed chair at Harvard.
At Harvard, okay. Yeah. So it dates to 1721. Mm-hmm. And are you the first woman since 1721 to hold that post?
I am. Yeah.
So what does that say? So it's interesting that we're talking about Mary Magdalene sort of reclaiming sort of women's role in the Gospels. Yeah. Why did it take so long for a woman to hold that chair?
Well, first of all, you have to hire women. you have to have women on the faculty.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, you know, recent in my lifetime. You know, I'm closing in on 65, you know, and this is the story of my generation. You know, I'm probably the second level group of women, you know, to really come into positions in higher education and at the Divinity School. So it was perhaps inevitable that sometime someone would, you know, hold this position. But it has to do very much with the history of women's roles in this country and in education.
I'm curious, though, if you think that there's any correlation between the lack of women in the sort of these chaired positions, these endowed roles at major universities, and the kind of scholarship that you've done? Is it, have women been underconsidered in the ancient history of the church because there haven't been women studying them?
Well, I think it's no surprise that, you know, there's never been any evidence that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. But it's no surprise that it's when women started studying in academic positions, were able to publish and look at these things, that we were starting to look at the history of women more broadly, not just in the church, but, you know, women's history has been an important field, you know, since World War II, for sure, that there would come to be an attention and focus on this. I mean, we've made all kinds of corrections, not just about Mary Magdalene, but there's a woman who's mentioned by Paul the Apostle in the letter to the Romans, where that name was changed to a man's name. You know, even though the earliest texts, it was a woman, Eunia, and they changed it to a male's name, Eunius, just a, you know, just a couple changes in the letters. But because the notion was that a woman couldn't be an apostle, because Eunia is called foremost among the apostles by Paul in the letter to the Romans. And so everybody went, it's a little bit like the apple, right? Women aren't apostles, you know, that's got to be a mistake, so let's fix it, right? And so it was now corrected back to its original form, which is to show that here's this woman. And who did that? Bernadette Bruton, you know, scholar at Brandeis, you know, feminist woman trained working on this literature.
I was raised in the Catholic faith, and I went to parochial schools, and I can tell you that the view taught there and what I would have believed as a 10 or 12 or 14-year-old was very much in the traditional Mary Magdalene was a sinner.
Yeah.
And that was it. And so this this obviously would have been a revelation then. I think it is even now. I want to ask about a quote you gave to Harvard Magazine about the question of why she's married. Does it matter or not? Does it make a difference? And you said, well, it makes a big difference. It touches everything from people's most intimate sense about their lives and their own sexuality to large institutional structures. It affects who gets to be in charge, who gets to preach and teach, who can be pure and holy. Should people be married or not? Can you be divorced or not? Is sexuality sinful by definition? All of this depends on what kind of story you tell. I mean, that's a pretty profound summary of your work. Do you want to expand on that a little bit? I mean, this is a question of relevance, much relevance today, certainly in the Catholic faith, where priests cannot marry, where women cannot be priests, and we could go through a long list of issues within the church now, or questions that some people have with the Catholic faith today.
Yeah, so I think this is precisely the power and the politics of storytelling. It matters what story we tell, and it matters getting it right. You know, because so much gets laid on, especially these texts, you know, especially for Christians, the biblical texts. And Christianity today is a global religion. The Bible is a global book translated into I don't know how many languages. And so how this story is told is so important. And sexuality, you know, and gender roles, these go right to the core of who we are. You know, and so much these days is about precisely these questions of who can marry whom, you know, who is valued, what matters. And it's very important, I think, to know that early Christians were struggling mightily with these issues. And to a certain degree, it's not only in the portrayal of women, you know, Mary the Mother, you know, the Virgin, Mary Magdalene, the repentant sinner, but also Jesus. You know, they were also trying to discuss this question about whether or not he was married or not. You know, and the first person to actually say he was not married, okay, was a heretic who claimed that Jesus wasn't married, and so nobody should be. Christians should not be at all. And the church pulled back from that position, but they made celibacy superior to marriage. And the problem was that desire, you know, and sexual desire was understood to be something that compromised the purity and the full integrity of a person. And this heritage, of course, has had enormous implications anywhere where Christianity is a powerful tradition.
You know, we've got a couple of minutes left here. One of the, I think the popular understanding of Mary Magdala and her role in early Christianity, I don't know if it's accurate to say it got a boost by Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, but certainly it popularized some of these ideas. From your perspective, you know, were those books useful to public understanding of this new scholarship, or not so much?
Well, they were certainly controversial, you know, and certainly raising even that issue and putting it out there, you know, for people to ask and to realize that we don't know the answer to that question, you know, was a beautiful teaching moment, shall I say, you know. I don't think that Dan Brown's portrayal is historically accurate, you know, so in that sense, you know, it's kind of fake news.
Right.
You know, but putting the question out there and letting people realize that this is again a place where both believers and I think anybody in the Western world who's been impacted by Christianity, which is actually not just the Western world,
right.
You know, is in good stead to look at those questions and to think about them and to see what kind of impact they've had.
You've written several books, many articles, a lot of scholarly research. Are you working on anything now that you could talk to us about?
Well,
that we could be looking for at some point?
I've been writing on the Gospel of Mary, which was actually not found in this Nag Hammadi, but was found earlier at the end of the 19th century, one of these codex books with early Christian texts in it we didn't know. And that text is actually takes this moment in the Gospel of John, okay, where Jesus appears to Mary and tells her that he has not yet ascended, but go and tell the disciples I am ascending, okay? And she goes and tells them. And then this happens in the morning, okay? And then in the evening, he appears to the disciples. What the Gospel of Mary does is it does what a lot of early Christian literature does, is it takes this moment and it retells that story. And it tells it in ways that lets one see, I think, a deeper understanding of the Gospel of John. It lets us see that the importance of the portrayal of Jesus as someone, the Son of Man, who came down and who rises back to God and who tells this story about the soul's rise to God. And so I'm working now on a commentary for the publisher Hermeneia for Fortress Press that's going to be looking more precisely and in greater detail precisely at this book.
We will look forward to that. Karen King, thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We hope you'll join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.